Solve a Mystery. Hello, guys. Welcome back. We're still here. Finally covering the end of season 5. I feel like it's been like 2 years. It's been a long time.
A couple of Netflix specials in there.
Yeah, us cover. Yeah, between global pandemics and the Netflix series. Which actually, if I'm sure people listening to this know this, but they're coming. What, spring?
They're coming
out with new Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix.
I think they got delayed again, but I'm not positive.
Well, I know. Well, they announced more episodes, but maybe they just didn't say when. But I guess it's another 6. But yeah, so it's Dan. I'm joined by the Dans. David and Howell is always joined by Road Dan here with me at home. Home Dan
now.
And Dan Derwin in Staten Island is always in a dreary,
good to be back,
rainy, poury, downy night in
no lightning though
in Staten Island.
No lightning, but back to back rainy recordings for me on this podcast.
Nice. And yeah, I mean, shit. Yeah, we're back. We're gonna do this. We're season 5, episode 24 to be specific. And there's a lot of shit to get to. So let's start with this lost loves, I guess. Miriam. It's just Miriam. Right? She never gives her
Miriam, real, not Miriam, right?
Yeah, she never gives her last name.
It's a very unique name at the Miriam, same time.
Miriam. Doe.
It's like Helen or Maud, Gertrude, right?
Does he just go by Miriam because, you know, she doesn't belong to the Maguires nor her biological?
Miriam's her first name. So anyway, she's this woman who's looking for these foster parents that she had for like a short amount of time. She just has like vague memories of them. So at the time of the story, she's 50 years old. She lives in New York. She's got a grown kid. She's a widow. And she just volunteers and, you know, spends her time with other widows. And in 1982, she's doing a regression session, or she's in a session with a psychologist, when she begins to have these like violent like memories. And she starts remembering her dad in a different light. And she starts remembering all these she remembers like a specific abusive episode over a coconut, which the reenactment is like, oh, man.
Wow.
I remember
it's delightful.
Dude, well, what's funny about it, this is like I last week, you know, we were watching the episode, or a couple weeks ago whenever we did the last episode, you know, that episode finished and I went to like the other room to go do something, and I just walk in the middle of this reenactment, like totally out of context. And yeah, I was like chuckling. I mean, it's awful, but it's just, the reenactment is this bad that I was just like I just walked.
I mean, his wife was accurate when she said, not with that knife.
Yeah. In a sort of,
he basically tried to cut the coconut open with a butter knife.
And she, oh my gosh.
And it causes him to snap, literally snap.
I had so many questions. Like, I didn't even know.
Fucking snapped.
I didn't know what he was fiddling with. Like, I didn't know it was a coconut, and you know, until I went back and watched this episode, I didn't remember this case at all.
He was also drinking, because right before she leaves, he's on the couch with a bottle.
Yeah. And she also, like, before she gets into these specific memories, she also has these frightening images of a man with a cloth wrapped around his face, like a mummy or something.
Oh yeah, that was weird.
Oh, yeah, that would be the orderlies wrapping Daddy down to the stretcher.
Yeah.
Oh, at the end of the reenactment, they had the cops there, and then they had the orderlies, as Robert Stack calls them. But going back to the why she had the regression psychotherapy, like,
kind of vague.
Was she trying to access these memories that she knew of, or was this just a session with her psychiatrist that just, it came out of nowhere? And
I feel like all the widows just went out to go try the new regression therapist.
The new trend of the week.
I don't know. They're very vague about it. They just say,
test driving a car.
They say she's retired. She's got a grown daughter and a dead husband, and she hangs out with widows. And that's all we get.
It's a choice.
And then cut to her, you know, with this psychiatrist or psychologist.
With the coconut.
Next week, we're trying out tarot card readings.
see if that works.
So she had all these flashbacks, and it began to affect her because she started having these dreams, and she, you know, they have the reenactment of her like crying on the bathroom floor in the middle of the night.
With a teddy bear.
With
I thought that was in the bathroom because it looked like she was in front of the.
I thought I said bathroom.
No, it was a bathroom. She was in front of a tub.
Yeah. So with all these memories she has no memory of, which is, I don't know, redundant. Not redundant. Confusing. Anyway.
It just basically opened up a Pandora's box of what the hell am I thinking of? And now she just kept having these flashbacks of shit that she doesn't know whether or not they happened or not, you know?
And the psychologist believes that they're regressed memories and they are real. But, you know, it's hard for her to prove it.
Why did her mother give her up?
Yeah, and they don't really talk about why the mother gives her up. Like basically, I mean, we jumped ahead a little bit, but it doesn't matter. So, the whole fight debacle, no, the whole coconut debacle happens. And then she just remembers, like, straight up, like, the paddy wagon coming. Like, literally, like, people in white coats, like, strapping him down.
Yep.
Accompanied by the police, and they like take him on his way, and then she just remembers this couple, right? This sweet couple, and she remembers being taken care of, and she remembers very specific things about them and stuff. But we'll get to that in a second. But the dad dies in 1984. She can't really confront him when she's an adult and ask him any of these questions. The mom straight up denies like her ever being in foster care, which is super odd, but like, you know, and she also said that she remembered the father having erotic behavior, but you know,
nothing. Erotic behavior or erotic behavior.
I did say erotic, erratic sure behavior. Yeah,
was he sure a did. Leather daddy?
He liked the chaps, the coconut dad, they call them.
She obviously comes to the conclusion as an adult that her dad had some unchecked mental illness, and you know, and then she believes that she was taken away so her mother could cope. Like that's the best explanation.
That's the bullshit. Yeah,
the question bullshit. That she asked. You know,
because they just crazy. Showed her right and like hanging out with that family. You know, and
she said,
like, "Well, how come the mom didn't hang on to her?" You know,
and she completely forgot about all this stuff. Like in one of her visualizations, as they say, she remembers these other mother and father, you know, figures, and she remembers
Pat
like
and Mike.
She remembers twirling the lady's hair, and she's being held, and she's singing "Tura Lura Lura" like a you know Italian lullaby and stuff.
Yeah,
and she remembers the dad is like a youngish man with gray or white hair, and he was a firefighter, and you know these people seem very picturesque and stuff, and she remembers calling them Mommy Pat and Daddy Mike, but then of course she has vague memories of a serious discussion between Pat and Mike saying that she might be taken away, and then she has memories of her in court with the social worker and being given back to her parents while she's crying, and then so apparently she stays with her parents until she's 21. Well, she stays with her she lives with her parents until she's 21, right? The dad doesn't die till 1984.
That's basically her parents for the rest of the time, but she moves out at 21, gets married, and then hangs out with widows.
Yeah.
Time jump.
The time jump is crazy because then at 47 she begins looking for Mike and Pat. Like out of nowhere. Well, I guess she really didn't remember, so. But it's weird that, like, even that young, she wouldn't remember. But I guess, you know, she was between, what, like 4 and 5 or something like that? Three and five?
When your dad comes at you with a butter knife saying, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty."
Oh, I forgot about that part. Like, she says like, that her
yeah,
dad.
Yeah, you're going to fucking bury those memories deep. But,
like, her dad was talking to her like an animal. Like, he wasn't even thinking
like, "Here, doggy," or "Here, kitty." Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some people still don't know if the Mama Pat and Daddy Mike thing was like maybe like a coping mechanism. They think it might have been false memory syndrome, but you know, because there was
but then the psychiatrist said something about like just based on the conversations that they had with her that they're most likely accurate memories.
Also, there was no court records and stuff. Like they couldn't prove that she had ever been fostered, but the people at the clerk's office told them that wasn't odd at all, especially for during that time after World War II and stuff.
Maybe she's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, very well could be.
Yes.
So she still hopes to find the foster parents. You know, she wants to thank them and stuff. But, I mean, even then, they would have been pretty old.
Yeah, he looked like a retiree when he put on that fireman's coat. He looked like he should have been done years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, she said a youngish looking man, but he still had gray hair, so he could have been, you know,
he looks late like 40s Mike Pence. Or whatever.
Mike Pence and mother. Imagine they're the ones. I don't think he would do anything that nice.
Mike Pence does seem like he'd be a good dad.
Yeah, I guess.
To a young girl, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he's Daddy Mike.
That's all I know.
He'd probably throw the ball around. I mean, atrocious guy, but, you know.
Sure.
Sure, but.
I just think he'd be a good dad for a kid who's between the ages of 4 and 8.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
I don't think his politics would affect being raised by him as a 4 to 8 year old.
Getting some ice cream, going to bed. You know, I feel like everything would just work.
Yeah.
Better
than coconut dad.
Coconut dad needs to fucking go.
So between 45 and 46, she was with these people and she wants to find them. And the result is she does not. But they do actually exist, right?
There's a photograph, right?
Yeah, some caller calls in and says that they did exist, and they sent a photograph of Pat when she was in her 30s. The viewer also said that the viewer claims that her and some other members of her church group remember that the Maguires had a child about Miriam's age in 1945. But she was never able to actually locate Pat or Mike or anything like that, and, you know, obviously – Unsolved, the wiki tells us that due to the passage of time, by now they're probably...
they're all dead.
They're all... They're all fucking deceased.
They're all fucking dead.
Can I just say the photo that they find of Mama Pat...
is kind of creepy.
Totally looks like an album cover for, like, an indie band.
Dude, I want to use it for an album cover now. Like, I wonder if who owns the rights to it.
It looks like a photo that you'd find Mama in like Pat. The lab in Resident Evil, and then on the back would have a code for a combination for safe in the lab somewhere.
Use this key, you know.
Lisa Trevor, 1985.
Is she pointing? Is she holding a gun? Oh, did you
see? Sorry, let's take a side note, but did you see that fucking trailer, dude? For the new Resident Evil?
Movie? I did. I have a feeling it's going to stink, but I'm pumped.
Dude, if they're sticking to the comics... It looks like a kind of CGI action fest, but like it, I'm already happy that it's going to be way better than, you know,
CGI movies. Looks a little cheesy in the trailer in and of itself, but the concept of it is straight from the games, part one and part two.
Yes.
So I have faith that the story is going to be pretty good. Execution, I don't know, but I'll be there for it. I'll be in the theater. I'm a big Resident Evil fan, so I'll fucking be there.
Yeah, I think the trailer looks like full-on horror, looks just like the game, and I'm hoping that some of the CGI in that trailer is a little early.
Yes. some of the CGI was a little tough, but...
The movie does come out in November. Yeah. So I don't know.
I do love that the movie exists.
Yeah. Fucking our dog just... fucking farted, and it's fucking awful.
I thought one of you's farted. I saw the door wave, and oh my god, that's great.
It's fucking rough. So this next case is the unexplained. Let's talk about Ghost Blimp. All right.
Fuck yeah, Ghost Blimp.
This name makes it sound way more cool than it is. We're talking about the crew of the L8, 1942. World War II, still not over, but, you know, approaching the end. United States still scared of the Japanese invasion on Western shores. So, and there was this big attack on an oil refinery in Santa Barbara. So they have these, like, a squadron of blimps that are, like, patrolling the coastline.
For the imminent threat that is the Japanese.
Yes. And basically, I guess, I don't know. I was like, this doesn't make sense to me, but then I'm like, I guess it does, right? Because there's way more monitoring to be done when you're going at a slow speed and able to kind of, you know, look at a whole area.
Look around, yeah.
And I guess, yeah, when you're in a blimp, like, there's not much, like, you have a 360-degree view, right? You know, you're just, like, in that little thing.
Almost.
Well, you know, more than a plane or anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't know they did that. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, this is, we're going to be talking about one of these blimps, the L8, that had a interesting thing happen to them. These two fools disappeared. Just after 6
a.m. That's interesting.
Just after 6 a.m., August 1942, an L8 blimp, the L8 blimp that was called Flight 101, prepped for takeoff. The pilots was a 27-year-old lieutenant named Ernest Cody and a 32-year-old ensign. Yeah, ensign, that's right. Ensign Charles Adams. And I don't know. That seems very English to me. Ensign.
Like Ansel Adams, the photographer?
Ensign, or.
He's a photographer? I thought he was a DJ.
That's Ansel Elgort.
Oh.
And he's an actor. You're the only person who thinks of Ansel Elgort as a DJ.
Seems like we know too many Ansels for three people.
He's an actor. Baby Driver. December's West Side Story.
I like, I, you said maybe, December's West Side Story. Dropping like, out release date in there too.
Coming out December. Our dear friend Alon might be in it. Did you met Alon, right?
Yeah, I met him that one time.
Yeah, he was fucking. He's a boxer. He was like, he was.
Yeah, he trains in Brooklyn or something.
He was an extra in West Side Story. Stunt
double.
Spielberg put him in the ring because they had these stunt doubles pretending to be boxers. And
that's awesome. Good for him.
Yeah, yeah. He liked the way that him and one of the other boxers from the gym were like sparring. And so they put him in all these crazy 60s costumes. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he's not in the movie at all, but I think it'd be kind of cool if he's just like in the background of like a musical.
Sure. Spielberg movie?
Hell yeah. Yeah, he said he got to go to dinner. He met Ansel and there was a cut on his face. And he was like, dude, that guy's fucked up. What the fuck happened to him? And they were like, that's makeup. Like, he's Tony.
It looks so good. Yeah.
That is pretty funny. He went to New Jersey and they made like a little area in New Jersey into 1960s New York. It's fucking badass.
Oh, really? It was Jersey?
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Anyway, Ansel.
Fucking Jersey.
Anyway, nothing to do with Ansel.
Fucking Jersey.
Ensign Charles Adams. Motherfuckers. both were experienced pilots. You know, they had flown blimps before, but one of them wasn't very familiar with the small blimp, which the L8 model was a smaller blimp. There was also an aviation guy named Riley Hill who was assigned to go on the flight as well, but right before they left, they made him leave the ship, and he thinks now that because of the heavy moisture in the air that maybe the third person would weigh down the blimp, so he stayed behind.
I like how during this segment they just consistently played that Unsolved Mysteries, like, ghostly war music on loop.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like Medal of Honor, the video game, or Call of Duty. Really, it's got like that.
Yeah.
Like that low ghostly. It's, and it was seriously on loop throughout the whole fucking
segment.
Like,
there's like snare in it. Like,
yeah. Some little light paradiddling.
Hey, production spent a lot of money on that sample.
They spent a lot of money on a guy to score like four different genres of mysteries, and they just use them over and over.
I know. I have the soundtracks.
We got four bars of this. We got to make it work.
Well, the soundtrack, I feel like, is only the ghost and scary stuff. Like, I want the...
There's more editions that we have yet to buy.
Well, there's only one more. I want the Grifter song. Ding, do, 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 do. Every time there's a Grifter...
Or Western's Lost Loves.
Every time there's a Grifter, it sounds like a 1920s, like, you know.
Yeah, it's always the 1920s, like, Elliot Ness era jingle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, okay. All right. So this is what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to leave Treasure Island. and they were going to, their flight path would take them to across the Golden Gate Bridge. And then.
How scenic.
And then they would float towards. float? I don't know. They would fly towards the Farallon Islands,
glide.
About 20 miles off the coast. And then from there, they would head north towards Point Reyes and then south along the coastline. So it was just like a weird kind of triangle that intersects.
A little bit of a bow tie.
Yeah, yeah.
Half a bow tie.
And so everything's going good. First hour and a half after takeoff, they radio headquarters, let them know that they're positioned 3 miles from the Farallon Islands. And then 4 minutes later, he calls again and said he wanted to investigate a suspicious oil slick. And that was the last time that the crew has ever heard from. So they didn't call in their hourly position report. That made everybody concerned. And then after 3 hours of radio silence, they get a message from the San Francisco Shore Patrol saying that a blimp was seen crashing into a golf course next to a beach. So they get down there. The blimp is about 8 miles off course, flying into Daly City.
Yep.
Daly City.
Like the and Rancid the, song.
And the blimp was soon noticed by so a bunch of people saw this thing drifting slowly down towards the city. And so, you know, one witness said she was coming home from Sunday school. She was a teenager at the time. And she sees
Bunny Gillespie.
Yeah, good old Bunny. That's a great name.
Bunny Gillespie rules.
Bunny Gillespie seems like she definitely sings show tunes at the Forum.
That she hung out under the bleachers at the football games.
Oh, yeah. Old Bunny. Old hand job Bunny.
Old handy Bunny.
Bunny with the handies.
Quite popular amongst the boys.
So, yeah. So they see
Bunny's making with the handies.
These people see the blimp like slowly coming down, losing altitude, and they're scared that it's going to get tangled in power lines. One woman's house was like kind of clipped by it, right? It dragged across her roof for a little bit.
Yeah, Mrs. Appleton.
No one's hurt, thank God. And there was nobody in the blimp when it crashed, right? The helium bag was leaking, and the two men were missing. The door latch was open.
Missing life jackets.
Yeah, no life jackets. The safety bar was no longer in place. A microphone.
And some very important briefcase with codes and shit was still there.
Oh, yeah. That's very vague, too. They also talk about the microphone that was hooked to an external loudspeaker that was dangling outside of the gondola, which I guess is what they call the little thing at the bottom.
The little basket.
Yeah, the little basket, right? Yeah, that's better. Gondola, I just think of like those pointy boats in Venice, right?
I think of like Roosevelt Island, like the gondola. You take that like across from Manhattan to Queens.
I think wardrobe cases.
What do you mean?
The term for wardrobe cases on Broadway are gondolas.
Oh, shit.
There's some shinfo.
I like how we all brought a different version of gondola to this conversation.
There you go. The more you know.
Sure.
The ignition switches and radio were still on. Oh, yeah. The ignition switches and radios were also still on. And then, of course, the weird top secret documents that are vague. And I guess they can't get into that too much because, you know,
it was a nuclear blimp.
No one saw anybody jump out of the craft, but also, like, you know, it was a pretty long stretch that they did, you know, with people watching the whole time. But yeah, immediately after they start calling it the ghost blimp because no one's there and there's just a blimp that lands by itself. And they can't figure out what the explanation is.
And then they eventually turned it into a Goodyear blimp and it was seen over sporting events into the 60s and 70s.
That's funny. That is funny. This mysterious thing was
I can solve this mystery.
Yeah, this mysterious
thing. Yeah, we solved it. It's above the fucking 49ers game in San Francisco.
The ghost blimp.
The crew is definitely dead. Has to be.
Oh, totes.
Totes.
But how?
The blimp.
That's the mystery.
A bunch of people had seen the blimp between 7 and 11, but nobody saw anything weird happen. Some were even close enough to the blimp to see the pilots inside, and they said everything seemed to be normal.
Normal for blimp activity.
Yeah. August 17th of 43, the men are presumed dead officially. And yeah, it's a Goodyear blimp now. I guess not now, probably.
Probably not now, no.
No, the new Goodyear blimp is state of the art. uses hydrogen.
Do they still use them? I haven't seen a blimp in a long time.
Yeah, they do for sure, right? I feel like
there was one floating around El Paso the other day. I don't know if it was the Goodyear blimp, but yeah, there was like some blimp slowly creeping across the skyline.
Oh man, I was watching Jimmy Kimmel the other day, and he was doing one of those things where he asked people in the streets like stupid questions, and I forget what it was. Like they would just make up crazy news stories and tell people like, "What do you think of this?" And this lady was like, "Yo, I saw an alien the other day. Like it was following me. Like I swear it was looking at me." And she pulled up the pictures of it, of the UFO, and it was clearly the Goodyear blimp. Like clearly. And she was and she was just like not convinced. Like she's like, "No, that's what I'm saying. Like it was going slow." It's like, "Yeah."
Yeah, it's a blimp.
It's pretty amazing. It goes
as fast as the wind.
So
what do you think happened to these dudes?
Well, there's fun theories. Let's go through the fun theories before we get to the boring, probably real answer that I think it
aliens. Yeah.
Well, there's the one that they
obviously aliens, Dan.
They obviously did spot a Japanese submarine and they descended to investigate it and they were pulled out and taken hostage, which
is bullshit because in my mind, if you're in a blimp and you're hovering above a submarine.
How do you get from a blimp to
they have to come get you.
How do you get from a blimp to a submarine? Like, I don't know.
And then if you're taken hostage, why didn't they take the secret codes?
This is not a this is not a Tom Cruise movie. This is not a Sean Connery / Alec Baldwin movie.
When a submarine and a blimp face off, no one gets out. Right?
They just stay in their respected spaces. Yeah. The water.
I'm not coming down. I'm not going up. That's it. Just long face off until.
Did they use like a really big ladder to board the ship?
I think.
Well, actually, in that case, I think the submarine would win because the submarine can't drown, but the blimp can run out of fuel.
I'm just thinking of like Batman and Robin, like Adam West, and the like on the rope ladder. You know, when they're like fighting the shark, you know, and they're just like hanging down
the shark repellent spray.
Yeah,
classic.
That's what I'm thinking. I think my favorite theory though is, I'm going to read it verbatim. Another theory was that the two men were involved in a lover's triangle with an unknown woman. According to this theory, one had murdered the other in a jealous rage and then fled when the blimp reached and then land.
Killed himself?
No. He did a run and tumble. That just seems that's hardcore fan. That's some hardcore fan fiction right there. Like,
I feel like that's a little too spicy for.
There was a lover's 40s. Spat. They were both in love with the same woman, but they were also in love with each other. That's why they kicked homeboy off.
I love Helen. No, I do.
But I also love Let's you, go to a blimp Greg. And
talk about it.
Wait, I don't think any of their names were Greg, but some hopeless romantic.
No, it's like one of their names are like Hugh.
Ensign something.
Yeah, exactly.
The Navy theorized that it was an accident, possibly a mechanical malfunction on board.
That one was pretty believable when I heard that one.
Yeah, you know, sometimes a blimp just malfunctions and two crew disappear from it.
Or
yes.
Well, that's something. Some that they climbed outside to fix it. One of them, and then they ran into Trumbull and the second man. They both fell.
The second man went to go give him a nice hug from behind.
Yeah.
And
then they both went off. Just whisper sweet nothings into his ear. It's a romantic story.
I've been waiting to get you up.
So this is what I'm saying.
A long time, Hugh.
Yeah, just me and you up here in the old blue sky.
You're the helium in my sack.
Oh, that's good. I like that. Okay, so here. So one of them climbs out because they're like, "Oh, we got to fix this little thing on the gondola." And then,
could say they were falling in love.
And then, the other one is like, "Oh yeah, let me help you." And then they slip and they grab the microphone and to hold on to it. And then they both fall into the oil. And then there was an oil slick. Maybe they just fucking fell into the oil slick and
drowned. Oil slick slicked them out.
That would have fucked them up. Like it would have filled their lungs.
For whatever
their
reason, when I heard about that mysterious oil slick, the first thing I thought of was Creepshow 2 with the raft.
Dude.
Right?
I remember I was really excited to watch Creepshow 2 because I hadn't seen it, and I read The Raft, like the little Stephen King short story, and I was very underwhelmed by Creepshow 2. It's just like a floating trash bag. Maybe I need to go back to it. Maybe I'm being a little too harsh.
Did you like the to read it, or did you?
The short story is fucking terrifying, but
okay. Oh, so the short story is good, but I watched it in like the last few months, and it I still enjoy it. Yeah, it's still goofy, and it's Creepshow. It is and goofy, Stephen King. Yeah.
But the
it's fucking goofy.
There's some cool shit in that. I forget where the night maybe. Skeleton
I love
crew?
Those first two creep shows with the Indian the wooden Indian statue in the first one.
Yeah,
with George Kennedy.
I'm way less familiar with the second one. I have it though. I've seen it a couple times. Yeah, the
and the hitchhiker,
the cigar store Indian is really
ride,
good,
lady.
Yeah, you know what? I was having this conversation. I feel like Creepshow one, like every segment needs to be like 10 minutes shorter.
I love Creepshow one.
I like it too, but I can kind of almost do without the cockroach one, and I feel like a lot of them are just too long. I don't know. Fix it, George Romero.
Yeah.
I don't
Get
know.
On it.
But yeah, Creepshow. Do you like, have you been watching the show? The TV series?
Oh, the one on Shudder?
Yeah.
No, I have not. I have Shudder. I'm watching a bunch of old other dumb shit.
Dude, you should.
But I haven't watched that yet.
You should watch it. There's like three seasons now. They only do like 6 episodes a season, but
okay.
It's like
they're good.
Oh yeah, like the guy who does it is Greg Nicotero, who does all the practical stuff for Walking Dead and stuff. But he, I mean, he started like he was like a teenager working on Dawn of the Dead, like with Tom Savini. And there's like a hardcore love, like it's just fully made, but it's low budget, like not that much CGI, and it's just like made by a bunch of hardcore horror nerds. Like I was listening to this podcast with one of the directors, and she was talking about going on set, and like she's like, I've never seen a better like collection of awesome horror TV, like horror movie shirts, like than on the Creepshow set. But there's a lot of good ones, like, and they're all goofy and kind of morality tales. Okay. And
I'll check them out. I had Shudder on the other night, and the last thing I was watching was, I forgot the fucking name of it, but it was like Cheerleaders Die or something with cheerleaders.
Oh, there's some good shit. Have you seen Terror Train with Jamie Lee Curtis?
No, I have not.
It's a cool one. It's like a slasher with like a whodunit kind of like twist ending.
I'll check it out. Yeah. Shudder's been great. I got it a few months ago. It's,
oh man, I got Mad Rex for
it's a great subscription.
I got Mad Rex for Shudder, but yeah, dude, for sure check out.
Highly recommended for those who don't have it. It's a horror streaming service.
For sure, check out Creepshow. There's one really great episode that's extra special if you're an Evil Dead fan. It's essentially Bob Ross versus the Evil Dead, like. Necronomicon and everything, like it. Tom, Ted Raimi, and the Necronomicon are in the episode.
Yeah, it's great. You
know,
that's awesome.
You know, Ted Raimi played the old lady in the cellar. Like he always played the monsters for his brother.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome. There's a lot of cool stuff, and there's they've adapted a couple of Stephen King shorts and a bunch of Joe Hill shorts, Stephen King's son. Which is kind of cool because he was the little voodoo boy in Creepshow. Like he was the, like that's Stephen King.
I was not a fan of In the Tall Grass.
Oh,
I watched that one. That took a while.
You didn't like the movie?
No, I like the short story, 60 pages, but I feel like,
dude,
they got to the end of the short story with 45 minutes left in the movie. And I was like, what the hell is it going to show? And I felt like it kind of dragged on.
So I liked that movie, but yeah, the short story was way fucking meaner.
Yeah, the short story was great. I enjoyed that.
It's so mean and bleak. But I liked what they did with the movie, because with the movie, I really did want them to escape. Like, I wanted there to be a happy ending. When I'm reading, like, especially a Stephen King short story, I expect everybody to fucking die. I expect it to be bleak as fuck. But if I'm like, a movie or a full novel, like, come on. I want it to be.
So basically, that's really what happened to the two guys from the blimp. As they walked into the tall grass, and
that was it.
We're never seen again.
Maybe they got Langoliered.
Oh, that's another.
Ooh.
They need to remake Langoliers.
They got Tommy knocked.
They totally need to do that.
But yeah, fucking yeah, dude. Yeah, Creepshow is like premium B horror, and the acting is kind of also a fun part of it too, because it's all Georgia like local casting. Like every episode will have like somebody sort like one person that's maybe kind of famous, but it's I'll
definitely check it out. But I actually have it saved. That like I I hit it. I put it in my to watch list on Shudder. So I just got to do it.
And the vibe too, like you'll love it. Like they do the crazy comic backgrounds. Like, you know, when something happens and it's like purple with like all this like sharp, yeah, like lightning kind
when
of.
When Leslie Nielsen, everything floats. No, that's everything floats. That's it. When he says, I could hold my breath for a long time the first Creep Show. Remember when they do like and they show all the flashing colors behind him, yeah, he's laughing.
All that stuff.
The same shit. That's what I think of. Yeah.
Leslie Nielsen and Ted Danson. And just the way they're all the monsters talk in that. Like, yeah, it's so good. Creep Show. Yeah, you can hear the like wetness in their voices.
Makeup is great. Special effects it's great. That's why I like the first Creep Show. That segment alone, I think, is the reason why I like Creep Show 1 best.
Yeah. I love when the one where he feeds his wife to the monster. But
under the stairs, the wolf in the box.
But that one for sure could be like, could lose 10 minutes.
Yes. They don't need to like sacrifice three people before they figure it out.
Yeah. But. Yeah. It's great though. I mean, George Romero's always kind of, he worked kind of slow. He'd always build it up. People just think of zombies, but he did a lot of more interesting movies than just zombie movies. Anyway, let's get to.
You want to start the next segment? I'm just going to get a refill. Yeah. I'll be back in 2 minutes.
All right. Reggie DePalma is a guy from Danbury, Connecticut. He's a well-respected firefighter, pillar of the community, whatever the fuck that means. He organized and ran a local explorer's post for the youth of his community.
I think that's an actual title. I think local explorers post is like a Boys Club of America, Boy Scouts of America. It's a title, or it's a club.
Like, we're the local explorers.
Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
We're the local explorers, and I'm running this post of the local explorers. Like this, like,
yeah, like a chapter,
like just chapter at the firehouse. All right, we're using context clues here, folks. Give us a break.
Yes,
we assume it's some sort of like, you know, like bisexual Boy Scouts. Well, not gender non
co-op.
Gender non-specific Dave. Boy Scouts / Girl Scouts. Bisexual
co-ed.
Wow, you're really putting some quotes in this thing.
Gender non-specific. Gender fluid. No, that's not what that means. That's not what that means. It's a gender fluid. It's a Boy Scouts for only people in the LGBTQIA community. No, guess, yeah, that's not what really gender fluid means. What's the fucking thing? Unisex. Co-ed? Just say, yeah, unisex. Unisex. Yeah.
UNICEF?
I forgot what UNICEF is. Insurance?
UNICEF is to stop.
Yeah, there was like those little milk boxes with the coin slot in them.
Oh, fuck.
That you used to steal from. I mean, used to donate to.
All right, let's back up. Okay. So in 1978, he runs a local explorer's post for the youth in his community, which, yeah, we can't quite figure out what that means. Anyway, so his girlfriend Connie was the co-leader of the organization, and it became a popular after-school activity for a bunch of teens in the area. We're going to be talking about a couple of these teens that kept themselves anonymous. One is named Diane, and she loved it. She thought that they were very trustworthy. By 1981, the Explorers Post grew to include 15 girls and 10 boys.
Pretty unisex.
Yeah, pretty gender fluid.
Pretty UNICEF.
Not so much. Not really a sausage party.
Pretty non-binary. Using all these terms wrong.
All the worst terms. The terms are not accurate. I'm here for it.
Okay. Yeah. So, how long does it take to show someone a fire station and train them in first aid? I don't know. That's basically what it says they did.
I think it's more so like yeah, you learn some skill, but I think it's like just hanging out with your friends and like an after school activity. The parents don't have to watch you. It's like almost like a latchkey kind of shit, you know.
And it was pretty exciting, I guess, for them.
Yeah, a little bit of everything.
And I guess it was pretty exciting for them because, like, you know, they'd be training and then all of a sudden they'd be interrupted by, like, a fire. And apparently...
Yeah, it was cool to see the adults, like, jump in the ambulance.
Did they do
off
ride-alongs?
And get on the big pole. The teens... Yeah.
No, it's not Kramer.
Well, no, because I was asking because, you know, the police have, like, most local PDs have an explorer program where you go on ride-alongs and...
You know, like Jerry and George in California looking for Kramer. the Keys.
Don't get me started. They put all those on Netflix and they fucking ruin the aspect ratio.
I haven't watched it on Netflix. Well, it's just, I watched all the DVDs like last year, so I did my marathon already. I'm good.
Yeah, my brother has the DVDs, and that's still the best way. I think one of the Blu-ray sets still...
They have a lot of bonus content per episode. They have a lot of inside looks and bloopers and bonus scenes for every episode. So it's worth it to watch it that way and soak in every episode in full.
I think they did have a Blu-ray set that was also square still, because what they're doing is... They're taking the square and they're making it into a fucking rectangle. You know, they're making it full screen, but by doing that, they're cutting off the top and the bottom. Like, they're not stretching it out. They're just cutting out.
Yeah, they're cutting off some of the top, but which is weird because I feel like I watched that. I watched the reruns on Channel 11 here, and you know, WPIX.
They're like that too.
They look great. They look great.
Yeah, but they're like that, right?
And they're in 16:9.
Oh, yeah, but they're in HD.
They're in HD, but so like I don't feel like I'm missing too much.
Wait,
or maybe if I am, I'm just not.
16:9 is widescreen, right?
It's widescreen. It's HD on channel 11.
But you are though. That's the and
I am missing it, I guess, but I'm not noticing. You know, it's not kicking me in the face. I guess.
Because it's not that specific. But people specifically were pissed off because like the pothole is cut out of frame. In the episode,
so you can't even like see
in the episode
Silver Zudo's keychain. Yeah,
in the episode, the pothole is cut out of the frame.
Okay, that's fucked up. Yeah,
but yeah,
like in the other episodes, like if you could only see half of Jerry's bike hanging in the apartment, who cares? But yeah, if you're missing the pothole and the key scene, yeah, that's a big deal.
If it's a show like I'm glad they never did it for like Twin Peaks, but a lot of people were pissed at like Buffy and. X-Files, like when they were cutting out stuff, but actually X-Files was film protected. Did you ever get into the X-Files?
No, I was not a big fan. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I just didn't watch it.
It's fucking, it's so good. But I barely watched them like 5 years ago.
Tim Armstrong from Rancid was on an episode.
Yeah. Because he was like obsessed with it.
He was like the trash king or some shit.
Yeah, yeah. And the new one, he told Chris Carter that's the only thing that the band could agree on is the X-Files tapes when they were touring in the 90s. The only thing that
they all watched that in a van driving around or the bus.
Yeah. Later on. Yeah. And Chris Carter got a kick out of that and put him in an episode. And apparently him and his son have been to Rancid concerts. Like they're friends with Tim Armstrong. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. It was like a mutual love affair.
Yeah. Same thing with Stephen King. Like, he always put the Ramones in his songs, and then they write Pet Sematary. Like, the Ramones in his Pet Sematary. Like, in his books, like when you read Pet Sematary, when the little boy gets hit by the truck driver is...
It's a Sheena is a punk rocker.
Yeah, there you go. It's fucking...
Were the Ramones mentioned in... No, it couldn't have been because it was too early. I was going to say, were they mentioned in Salem's Lot? But that book came out in like 78 or 79.
Yeah, I think they're...
Which could still be Ramones, but I don't think they were mentioned.
I think they're mentioned in The Stand.
They're definitely mentioned in Misery.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's one specific short story that I remember... or it might have been a novel. I remember Rockaway Beach is in something. Like the lyrics of Rockaway Beach, like... Someone's listening to Rockaway Beach. I'm sure there's a Stephen King wiki where you can find that shit out. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So Brian De Palma's – Brian De Palma?
Reggie De Palma.
Reggie De Palma. Another De Palma. Also a creep, but probably way less than Reggie. I love Brian De Palma. Anyway. Not Reggie. Reggie sucks. All right. So another teen named Terry was very close with De Palma and his girlfriend. And so Terry and Diana are like anonymous storytellers here. And Terry tells this awful story of in October 1 year, the group had organized a haunted house to help raise money for an upcoming camping trip, which is also creepy. And while there, Terry, who was a 13-year-old girl, was asked by De Palma if she had like a boyfriend and if she'd ever gone all the way and super creepy shit like that.
Creepy shit.
Things you should know as a young woman.
He wanted to help her because he was her friend. It's fucking
just for the record, though, what I was going to say before, that haunted house is fucking awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
For like a makeshift like explorers club or whatever, like that's some decoration.
Yeah, that shit.
I was very impressed.
That shit gave me like 90s Halloween nostalgia for sure. And
there's a lot of work put into that.
And then it cut to a rape proposition, which kind of
correct, which is awful.
Yeah,
yes.
Which made my stomach churn, whatever. So yeah, the girl says that she felt a little irked by what he said. Like that's to say the least. So anyway, Connie comes up to her and asks her to come back to Reggie's apartment. And
she's playing good cop.
Yeah, and she was like, "Let's have fun, you know, just come, you know, we'll hang out." And so as soon as they get there, she tells Terry to take a shower so she can get all the makeup off of her, which is very weird. Like,
yeah, it's very creepy. It's terrible.
When you're 13,
that's awful.
Like, I don't want to take a shower at a stranger's house. Like, I'll just watch.
I don't want to take a shower at someone's house when I'm 40.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, I'll just wash my fucking face off in the sink. Like, get the fuck. What are you doing? But anyway, she trusted these people. She's a 13-year-old girl. She's like, you know, been in this group for a while at this point.
Very trusting, yeah.
So when she gets out of the shower, she's told by the girlfriend Connie to like come into the room. They're like, it looks like they're drinking champagne and watching. She's like, we're just watching TV. And she, in the reenactment, she's still in her, like, just in a towel. And then she tells us that she was forced to have sex with Reggie while Connie watched. Is the gist of it. Yeah, this happened to a bunch of girls. Diane was raped by De Palma. And over the next year, he started doing this to a bunch of other girls on the Explorers Post. Finally, one girl breaks and like confides. And then all the girls are like, wow, this is happening to all of us.
Yeah, they all band together.
Which is awesome. I feel like there's a really intense like movie in there somewhere.
It was very Breakfast Club of them. Like they're all sitting around like Indian style talking about the experience and being like, you know what? If you speak up, I'll speak up. And
for me, I'll
tell my mother today.
It was giving me kind of It vibes. Like
it was good. It was well done.
It was giving me It vibes, like the new It where all the kids are realizing that the same scary, awful shit is happening to them. But yeah, you know, and shit. There's a lot of Stephen King-y things in this episode, especially when we get to these kids having their little
Stephen E. King.
When you get to these kids having their little stand by me moment, and then they find a fucking skull. We'll get to that in a second.
That's the next episode.
So one of the girls confides in their mom, and the other girls back her up, and she immediately tells the police. Investigators question these girls, and they did everything to help them, I guess. Several of them say that he forced them to drink alcohol before they were sexually assaulted, and soon thereafter, De Palma was arrested by the police and charged with 5 counts of child molestation. Connie's questioned, and she pleads guilty to risking injury to a minor and was given a 5-year sentence, which is fucked. I'm currently listening to Last Podcast on the Left, and they're talking about the Barbie and Ken killers, which was Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. And they would rape girls and murder girls. And their first victim was Carla Homolka's 15-year-old sister. They're disgusting. And she was able to, like, get, like, 5 years in prison or, like, this ridiculous sentence. Like, she's fully free and she, like, murdered and raped multiple young women. And she's just, like,
it's terrible.
And she just kind of, like, oh, you know, like, she got away with it because she was able to convince a jury that, like, she was fully coerced by this guy. And it's, like, I don't know. I'm sorry. Connie should be
waiting. For Reggie De Palma, like, to be accused of one of the counts that you're accused of is risking injury to a minor makes it just like so much worse than like obviously rape, you know, child molestation, terrible, but just like to hear the words like risking injury to a minor, like that's how you like it's awful. It's just fucking disgusting.
Oh, like
to hear it spelled out like that is what I'm trying to say is that it's just oof.
Yeah, and especially it's very broad too. Like, but you know, when you're using it in that sexual context, it's like, ugh, horrendous.
And that even that detective, like right before they showed the court case or whatever, they had the detective who was felt ill. She goes, "I don't even know Reggie," and you know, I was disgusted hearing these girls' stories. Yeah, like, and there's like, no way that they were lying.
She said
and,
she felt you know. Guilty, like she felt bad or responsible for some reason. Yeah. Without like
she felt, yeah, she was disgusted just hearing their stories, and yeah. She didn't know them. But I mean, is there a sexier name than Ingrid Yakaki for that detective? I mean, I don't think so. I think that's pretty sexy. If
Dikaki. God, I didn't get that name at all. That's funny.
No, it's Yakaki. Yakaki. Ingrid.
So after 1 year after Ingrid puts this motherfucker under arrest, he goes on trial.
Yes, Ingrid's awesome.
He goes on trial for the rapes. The fifth day of the trial, he goes to New Haven to visit his sick mother, which is, come on, some
bullshit,
some weaselly shit, and he disappears, right?
He had like that long black coat and black glasses, like the ultimate, like, I'm getting out of here outfit, right? I'm not coming back.
Pretty much. Car is found in the hospital parking lot. Trail goes cold. And on October 25th, the trial goes on without him, and he's convicted of all charges. They call it absentia. He's sentenced in absentia to 20 years. He remained at large for a very long time. That's where the
17 years, I think, yeah.
That's where the original segment ran. This whole episode is pretty much, you know, May 93. This is the last episode of season 5. And they also say that this was featured on America's Most Wanted, rightly so.
So you're saying 93, and it took him 17 years to be found? He was on the run for 17 years?
He's captured. No. This all happened, I think, in the 70s. 78 is when he was raping and stuff. So he's caught.
Gotcha. Okay.
He's caught in 2000. Captured summer of 2000. America's Most Wanted viewers led to his capture.
Okay.
He was arrested in Florida. Like you said, 17 years on the run. He's got a wife, kids, four kids. And he was living under the name Lawrence Mateo. He's taken back to Connecticut, where he is sentenced to 21 years, but
he's been released already.
Yeah, he only served 14, I guess, more or less.
Ugh, too little for my taste.
Yeah, that's fucking ridiculous. Especially when you consider
they should have killed him.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, he'll be on the sex offenders registry for all time, but like, that's not enough. I mean,
that's terrible.
Yeah, like these were children. Ugh.
Fuck you, Reggie.
And he, in this picture of him as an older guy, he looks kind of like he looks like Matthew Fox from Lost. He looks like Jack from Lost.
That's a compliment.
It is a way too good of a compliment. He looks like if Jack from Lost's face got like rearranged, like a little bit of like Picasso vibe.
Reggie shouldn't look good. Reggie should not look good.
Well, that's the reason he was able to do all those fucking rapes. No, I don't know.
Yes.
God, just trust, you know, gaining these trust of little kids and, you know, just defiling that trust in such a like fucked up way. And then, fuck Connie. I don't know. These girls that get wrapped up in it, like,
yeah, we never heard. Oh yeah, we never heard what happened to Connie in the end.
I don't know. I want
to. She
find
never
out
went
more.
To jail, or she was not just as guilty, but she was up there.
I feel like she's almost just as guilty because she's like making these girls feel more comfortable because she's like, I'm a girl and this is like what we do, and also it's like, I don't know. People say that these people are in love and they're like coerced and they don't know better because they're so like infatuated. But it's like,
yeah,
it's taking the,
she said that she would do anything for him and, you know, she's under like some kind of spell.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's taking the whole, I'm into bad boys thing, like to a crazy level, like get your head out of your ass, Connie, you know, I don't know.
I agree completely.
So this bullshit. This last case sucks. Fuck. This last case sucks.
Fuck. Yeah.
It's a doozy.
It's interesting, though. It's interesting to talk about. Let's just get into it because this is a running long. January 72, two boys are fishing in the Taylor Bayou, Webster, Texas. And like we said, it's all nice. And the music is so charming and nice. And then one of them's like, what's that, a ball? And it's a human skull. These little boys find a human skull.
It's doing like that. It's doing like that Resident Evil safe music, the safe room music. It's like, doo-doo-doo.
Yeah, I've got some nice things for you, stranger. Stranger.
What are you buying? What are you selling?
Yeah, so they find a skull, and it belonged to a young girl. 6 weeks later, the authorities are able to track down the rest of the body, and these remains also included those of another girl. The dental records confirmed that they were the bodies were that of 14-year-old Rhonda Johnson and 13-year-old Sharon Shaw, who had gone missing the previous summer. Cause of death not determined. 5 months later, this 23-year-old guy who worked at a gas station named Michael Lloyd Self is arrested and charged with their murder. He's convicted of the crimes and sentenced to prison, and he's claiming that he's innocent. This is one of those final appeal cases. But before we get into his innocence, let's talk about Rhonda and Sharon themselves. Last seen August 1971, heading towards the Jericho Surf and Sea Shop in Galveston. So that's Galveston's that's, you know, Texas coast, right? Gulf of Mexico.
Right? Yeah. Gulf of Mexico. Mexico.
The investigation is launched and pressure is placed on the officers because Rhonda's grandfather was a prominent city council member. For some reason, that gives me Silence of the Lambs vibes. May 72, the Webster City Council hires a new police chief named Don Morris and an assistant chief named Tommy Deal, who came from the traffic division of the Texas DPS. And these guys are villains almost as much as whoever killed these little girls. These guys fucking suck. A few weeks later, after being hired, Morris gets this tip from a guy named Glenn Price about this Michael Self dude. And Michael Lloyd Self was a known sex offender who had been arrested for Peeping Tom stuff in the past.
Wait, I missed that. He was a registered sex offender?
Yes, he was.
I had written down that he was a Peeping Tom and that it doesn't help your reputation, but I didn't know that he was a registered sex offender.
Yeah, but...
because that does not help.
It doesn't. I do feel like there's a big difference between Peeping Tom and actually going into someone's house and doing it. But like I said,
I feel like George McFly wasn't a registered sex offender, but he was a creep.
Yeah, he was definitely a creep. He definitely, you know, there's something more to it than, you know. Do you think there would still be Peeping Toms if it wasn't for internet porn? I feel like that would still be a prevalent. I feel like it would be a prevalent thing if it wasn't for porn. Like internet porn
definitely extinguished some of those fires that were out there in trees with binoculars.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. So June of 72, 5 a.m., Tommy Deal and Officer Herman Morgan visit the gas station and they start accusing Mr. Self of all this shit. He's like, you know, I'm psychic, right? Like, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking about two girls. And he was referring to, of course, the little girls. Self was confused and thought he might be talking about
his girlfriend.
Yeah, he has a new girlfriend and an old wife. So he was like, okay, you know. And then later that morning, he goes to the police station and he recognizes pictures of Sharon and Rhonda. But that's also kind of uncooperated, right? Like some people are like.
It's no coincidence that they're picking on somebody who's obviously a little bit slow, you know. Like I feel like there's a habit of we've seen on Unsolved Mysteries in the past when they have guys on death row and final appeal, that most of the people who are behind bars that have to clear their name are a little bit slow, you know. It seems to be a habit picking on the weak and, you know, bullshit.
Recently we covered that case of that older redheaded guy who lived with his mom still, and he got charged with this murder because they found red hairs at the crime scene, but they were able to confirm that the red hairs didn't match, and that guy spent a bunch of years in prison. Yeah, it always happens.
I mean, he should have been charged with calling his mom mommy at 60 years old, but that's a different case, yeah. I guess, that I can make.
I mean, definitely not murder. He was differently abled. He wasn't. It wasn't like the last time we were talking about like those grown people. Those grown people talking about daddy.
Well, it's the same shit. It's mommy.
Yeah, but this guy was like a differently abled. Like, you know, he's not as, you know, he's not like a grown. He's not like an accountant. Okay, let's just put it that way. He wasn't a well-off person like that. Right. I forget the last time we were talking about shit about that.
I'll concede. It was the last time I was on. We were talking about my daddy.
The Jesus painting.
The Jesus paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that was different. I don't think they were differently able.
She was not slow. She was just.
Just had a weird.
Just special.
Just had a weird.
Just ridiculous.
Just had a weird daddy thing. Yeah. So he recognizes pictures of them. And then that night after coercion, he's arrested for their murders. And then when they're interrogating him, they claim that they have evidence that links them to the murders, but they didn't. And this other officer who is a talking head, he's older now and has great sideburns and seems like a 1970s.
And his name is David Coburn. Come on. Coburn, sideburn.
He's got good sideburns. But he was talking about how he noticed that how relaxed the guy was. Like, he wasn't nervous. He didn't seem like a murderer who just got called in. This other cop leaves the room, and the other dude fully takes charge. And then he starts asking him about why he killed the girls, and he wanted a confession, and he said he wasn't going to leave until he got some. And he, like, apparently he got him against the wall and, like, poked him in the stomach with the nightstick, like, a bunch of times. And then he
did. Yeah, but he looked like he was jerking him off.
Yeah, because he wasn't hitting him hard at all, like, in the reenactment. Like
the elbow going back and forth, yeah. No nightstick.
It just looked like he was helping out his buddy.
He's giving him a good interrogation tug.
Yeah, yeah. Relieving the stress.
As you do.
That's what happens.
So this is the crazy thing, is this whole, like, Russian roulette thing. Like, apparently Morris takes out 5 bullets from his gun and then, you know, spins the chamber and, like, threatens to shoot the guy if he doesn't confess and tell him what he did. So it's like straight out of like a Western movie. And
I heard that dog.
I know, fuckers. Morris said that he had seen this guy do the same Russian roulette bit in another interrogation. And so that lent some credence to the guy's story about that crazy, you know, Russian roulette incident.
Those fucking scumbag cops. He had, like, that whole thing is just fucking terrible.
Yeah, it's bullshit. He had a confession and it didn't work out, didn't match up, so he wrote a different one. He fixed it and wrote a different confession. And this is all under the cop told him what to write. Like, after he finally said he would confess, he told him exactly what to write. And even the second confession had a bunch of stuff that didn't, like, add up. Like,
it didn't match up to the crime.
Yeah. The things that didn't match up was he claimed he dumped Sharon and Rhonda at El Largo, which is 20 miles from Taylor Bayou, where they were actually found. He said that he choked one of them, but there was no evidence of any injuries to their necks like that. He also stated that he picked Sharon up from her house, and the family contradicts that. They would remember a grown, creepy man picking up their 13-year-old daughter.
Of course.
They also said that the girls were apparently hollering and waving and hanging out of his car, but no witness could corroborate any of that. And actually, a witness places both of them in Galveston at 9 p.m., even though the confession said that they were already with him in Webster by 9 p.m. So, you know, it's complete bullshit.
He had a lot of people speaking for him in his defense in this episode. He had a lot of lawyers.
Yeah, he did.
They had that one guy that Gerald Bernberg or whatever. He looked like a Guess Who piece.
You know,
like the
Guess Who character,
the board game.
Completely did. I was like, I really like this guy, but his fashion is insane. Because he was like, he had like a really receding hairline, but it was also very kind of poofy. And then
it was like, he was bald, but then at the end he was like, ah, fooled you.
Yeah. Not. And then he had like a handlebar mustache, but it was very thin.
Yeah. And like I said, is your character bald? Yes. No, I can't tell. And then that's how you win Guess Who.
And then he also had like an interesting loud tie. Yeah, he was
cool. Yeah, and he was in defense of Michael Self.
Another fucked up thing is 2 weeks after Self's arrest, two sheriff deputies check him out, telling him that they're going to buy him dinner. And then they go to all of the places that he said he committed these crimes at, and they take pictures of him in front of them.
So stupid.
And they present it in court as another confession, which is...
Yeah, like, the third confession.
Doesn't make sense. I don't understand that. Obviously, it's legal.
And the one guy yells, he's like, it's not a confession. It's just photos of the guy at the location.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with anything.
What does that mean?
And Colburn, like I said, tells a story about seeing this guy do the same thing with another in another interrogation. And he wanted to testify, but he was never called to testify. So May 1973, he's convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. 3 years later, Morris and Deal are arrested and charged with bank robbery. These are the two cops.
Which is crazy. What a fucking what a twist.
Right? And it's like, you think at that point they'd be like,
I rewound it. I couldn't believe it.
You think at that point they'd be like, hey, maybe they're less than trustworthy. And then with all these people speaking on this guy's behalf, it's so shitty. So they're
once they got arrested for fucking bank robbery, it should have just been like, whoa, these guys coerced a confession from this guy. These guys robbed the bank. Can we go back to the drawing board, please?
Yeah.
Let's try this again.
I don't understand how that's not the thing that, like, he was like, okay, something's weird here. So they were part of this whole group that had been doing robberies since 1972. So 1976, Morris is sentenced to 55 years, and Deal is sentenced to 30 years. See, I want to back up to the last case for a second. This guy spends 14 years in jail for raping multiple teenage girls.
And yes.
First of all, he's only charged with 21. He only spends 14 years. And this guy robs a bank, and he's also a corrupt piece of shit cop. But 55 and 30 years, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's different. That's all I'll say.
I feel like it's very different. Different states, different time, different judges. It's just,
yeah,
it's a fucking crapshoot.
Yeah, who knows? So they're both eventually paroled, and Deal, fucking his dumb ass, gets arrested for robbery again, apparently, at some point.
He definitely doesn't help himself.
So Self's attorney keeps trying to get him a new trial, and April 1980. No, he's not Self, though. Self's the good guy. Self's the wrongly accused guy. This junk doesn't even work.
Don't. Leave us alone. Me and Dan are just having a good time.
So push for a new trial. So they're still trying to get him a new trial. He's in jail. It's 1980. And when this other guy walks in and confesses. The interesting thing about this guy who confesses to the murder of these two girls is he talks about the length of rope or cord that was used to choke
them. The color of cord and just the fact that in the reenactment, he looks like a fucking killer.
Yeah, he does. He has weird pants on.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I don't know what his pants are, but they're weird. But
definitely
anyway,
khaki.
But he says that he killed him. He has weird specifics, but he's also clearly mentally ill, and it's not enough to like put him there. He doesn't give enough specifics, you know. But interestingly, like the rope thing was something that was the thing that the cops kept from the public so they could be able to know if the guy was actually the killer if they found him. And this guy lived in the same apartment complex as one of the girls. Like, it's so frustrating.
Slam dunk.
So despite all this, his conviction, Self's conviction, is still upheld. Like, he's denied parole again in 92, again in 93, the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to consider a new trial. So many people let this guy down.
And then he died of cancer at 53 behind bars.
Yep. Never exonerated. Ultimately. Never exonerated. It's so sad.
And Don Morris was sentenced to 55 years. His sentence was long, even though we said that he didn't really, you know, serve his time, but 55 years.
Yeah, that's a lot for just...
It's a big-ass sentence for a bank robbery.
So they say that, yeah, even the cops think that, like, now the cops know that Self wasn't responsible for the murders.
Sure.
And they think that these girls may have been victims by an unknown serial killer in the Galveston area who There's a bunch of people that they're pinning, a bunch of victims that they're pinning on this unknown Galveston area murderer. So like you said, he dies in prison in 2000 and he's still never exonerated for Sharon and Rhonda's murders. They should do it posthumously. Goddamn. They should exonerate the guy posthumously. There you go. Yeah, because obviously two super corrupt cops framed his ass and it's, you know, it's all there.
It was fucked up. Fucked up way for that guy to go out.
So there's, they believe that this Galveston murderer, serial killer, murdered Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, Brooks Bracewell, and Georgia Greer.
That's some name.
Interestingly enough, Edward Bell, the guy who killed Larry Dickens, you know, Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey's character, yeah.
Yeah, apparently he was a person of interest for murdering these two girls. And fuck. But he died in prison in 2019, so. Yeah.
Too late.
He was a POI in that case.
I believe he was the one that came in and mentioned the black cord that was used.
Wait, the redhead did. The redhead did.
No, they would have said.
In a recreation.
They didn't say that guy's name because they weren't able to charge him with anything.
My bad.
But yeah, thanks for listening, guys. We're going to start season 6. And season 6 has like a new theme song and like a new opening
credits. Yeah, it's got a new intro. It's got new, it's got like that new like bronze artwork.
It's pretty cool. Whatever the fuck. Yeah, we got about 6 more of these seasons. Actually, wait, no, after this one, we have like 7 more. Fuck.
season six is like the beginning of where the intro starts to change. The first 5 seasons are all like that same old school intro, kind of old feel.
With like now slightly different.
A little bit more of an update. Yeah. Some of the cases are still good, but you start to drift into like that 90s feel now. But tonight's episode was the last of the old guard.
Last of the original
run. The OG stack.
Yeah. See what they come up with now. I want more Chupacabra. I want some more weird shit. But yeah, thanks for hanging out with us, staying with us. We'll be back whenever we're back. Hopefully next week. Same stack time, same stack channel. All right. Yeah, anyway, thanks for joining us. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Derwin and Road.
Thanks, guys. Happy New Year.
Thanks for hanging out with us. For every mystery, there's someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is listening, and perhaps that someone is you. All right. Good night.
Bye-bye.